That was very clever and brilliant. And
thank you very much.
Because straight away, it's so hooky. It's really, and it's great to actually hear lyrics and a story.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of, so I don't want to sound really old now, but you know, a lot of songs that you get, it's the same sort of repetitive thing over and over again. And I love songs where you actually go through and you're waiting for the next.
Yeah, well, my main thing is really story writing and telling stories with songs. I mean, I was in a Johnny Cash tribute band as a guitarist for 10 years, and they're all stories, you know, they're great stories, so.
And that's a kind of a mixture as well, because you've got a little bit of a ska kind of reggae influence.
Well, that's the clash thing going on, you know. I mean, we did sit down and talk about what we wanted to do with it, you know, once it got going, and, you know, that was a definite influence and something that I always wanted to do, because I love reggae. You know, I've loved reggae for a very long time. All forms of reggae as well. And because some of my songs that I'd written were like folk songs, actually they work really well with a reggae beat to them. So things like on the album, that Len's Lion was a folk song, and then we turned it into a reggae song, and it really worked really well. So, you know,
tell us about the House Martins, because that was
what do you want to know, Michelle?
Well, tell us about how you got together. We'll only cover it a little bit, because we are talking about this band and what you're doing now, but just tell us about, because you've won awards and all sorts.
In Hull, all the musicians know each other, so I bumped into Paul, and he was looking for a bass player, so I play the bass. And he says, do you know any drummers? And I says, well, there's a great drummer in the Gargoyles. You couldn't, I'm sure I could persuade him. So we, so that was sort of achieved. We started, I think I started putting the bass lines down, just listening to the demos and getting the bass lines in my head. And then being able to play the bass and sing at the same time, I found quite difficult. So I had to sort of time it, so I know what my fingers are doing, and, you know, to be able to sing at the same time. And then we used to rehearse, was it 70 De Grey Street, which was, it was like a bedsit where Paul and his ex-girlfriend Sue had moved up from, was it Dorking in Surrey? They moved up from there with a few friends. So we used to race in the kitchen with Hugh sitting in the, what we call a scullery. You know what a scullery is? You know, scullery. So it's the cold back room. So Hugh would be in the cold back room with his coat on, and we'd be in the kitchen with the gas on, you know, and then we'd just play through the songs. And with that, we started, because they were always ambitious. Paul and Stan were very ambitious. They wanted to go places. I think that's what attracted me as well. You know, you can play as much as you like in Hull, but it takes going down south to the capital to really sort of get people noticed. And, there was a connection with Billy Bragg as well, because they'd supported him at Spring Street Theatre, as it was called then in Hull. It's now called the Hull Truck Theatre, which is like a nationally famous theatre. So there was that connection. So we ended up going backwards and forwards to London on the National Express coach, because at the time, you could, if you bought 8 Mars bars, you got, you could get 2 for the price of 1 on the National Express coach. So, you know, we had a lot of Mars bars in the House Martins. And we'd go down just with the guitars and, you know, maybe the snare, and we'd pile onto the coach, we'd get to London, we'd have a gig, we'd turn up at the gig and borrow everybody's equipment. And eventually we had Andy McDonald from the label Go Discs come down to see us in Hammersmith, and we were again supporting another band. And he liked us enough to sign us. So, you know, that was a great big step forward.
As a collective, how do you write songs? Are you somebody that's actually sitting there and going, oh, got an idea, and you write lyrics down, then you put them to music? Or is it sometimes you're playing guitar and the lyrics come to you, or would you just jam, or is it different every time?
Well, I mainly come up with the song. So I'll have the lyrics and the chords. And then, Nick and Paul sort of arrange it. I mean, Paul, you won't have said anything about his background, but he's got a huge musical background.
Yep.
And he's not only a great bass player, but he's also a really talented producer. And when I started working with him just in his home studio, you know, it's, again, you can tell people who know what they're doing and are serious about what they do. And I thought, wow, this is really lucky. I'm really lucky to have Paul playing bass and, you know, having all those talents as well. So Paul adds a great deal to what my songs start out as.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll sometimes change a little bit. And, you know, there's one that we're working on, Autumnal Down, that's changed 3 or 4 times. You know, but that's because Paul is such a perfectionist. And he wants a good song to sound absolutely brilliant on record. You know, and then Nick, you know, when I came down to London these last few times, it was about 2 years ago, I did an open mic night, and Nick was the house drummer. And it was just great for me to play in front of a band again, because I hadn't done it for such a long time. And I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. And luckily, Nick liked the songs.
Yeah.
And Nick has got a really good funky feel to the drums.
Mm.
And I always wanted to be in a band that was like a bit funky, you know.
Because
I'm a sort of straight rock and roll, bit of folk.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll fit really well, you know. Mm. So Nick is sort of an arranger of the drums, I'd say.
Now we're going to talk about Dereem as well.
Ah.
Because that's you over there with your face. So tell us how did all that come about for you?
Dereem? It goes back an awful long way. It goes back to before Dereem. I was involved in making house records. I was involved in the whole underground house scene in London. And I worked with a guy called Mr. Mundy. And we worked together with the Damski. Do you remember him? We all sort of knew each other, and we were all working on records together. And Peter actually, he used to work in an office for me. And he played me songs, and he played me an early version of Things Can Only Get Better, of course. But he wasn't house music, he wasn't dance music at all, it was like an indie band. So I said to him, well, look, you know, the bands that you really like the Rolling Stones and the Clash, and you know, these, they're all part of the scene that was going on in central London. And the scene that's going on now is this kind of Italian piano sort of thing, house music thing. And it's based at this club called the Brain Club and Love Ranch at the Maximus. So I kind of took him to these places and said, listen, this is the sort of music you should be playing. So I kind of got him into it in the first place, in a sense.
Mm.
And introduced him to the main guys in Dereem were Peter and Al McKenzie, and I introduced them to each other.
Yeah.
So I was kind of right from the start, you know, and I was kind of involved. And Pete was very serious about it, again, like you were saying about Paul. You could see he was really driven.
Mm.
And that kind of really inspired me in a way as well. Yeah.
Have you recorded everything at your studio? Have you gone other places? And are you on MTR-90 sort of stuff? Are you on the old tape, or are you doing it to digital? Are you recording?
No, it's all done on Apple Mac now. I nearly bought one in the mid 90s because it was kind of vanity. I just wanted the idea of it. You know? But they were about 15 grand then. Or something.
Yeah, they were. I don't think they're worth that now. Or if my eyes are just lit up.
We recorded the drums round at Nick's place, and he's got a basement flat in
underneath a funeral parlour.
Yeah.
so we'd just do a rough tape of the drums, just a little 2-track thing. Then we'd take it to my studio, lay it out, and then that was the basis of the demos.
Mm.
We'd doing that for a year, and then the record company said we really like this, we'll sign you. So what we did then, we hired other studios. We went into another studio with big room in it to record the drums. And then we went to a friend of ours called Kev. He's got a studio on All Saints Road, you know, in the heart of Portobello Road. And we did all the guitars and things there in the vocals. So it was done in different places, you know, and kind of edited together afterwards. It's not everybody likes to think of it as being everybody sits around in a room like you see the Beatles things. Mm. It's not really like that anymore.
Yeah. Because you can write one place and then send it to somebody else, can't you? Just say, can you add this? And they could be anywhere in the world now.
It's done in different studios, different places, and assembled afterwards. But that's how everybody makes records nowadays, anyway.
Now, I've got a tricky question to ask you, Ted. What is the best lyric? And this isn't being a songwriter being a big head, but every songwriter has a song where they go, that lyric is, I'm a genius. What one is it for you where you sort of wrote it and you went, my God, that's a great lyric. Which one is it?
Well, I was thinking about that, and there was a song I was telling the guys about that I had a chorus for it, and then I changed the chorus and it just started to work. But then I tried to think back, and the one that sprung into my mind, I wrote a song called Bridge to Nowhere, which is about a bridge in Hull that was built, and it just goes across the river to a Premier Inn. And it didn't seem to make any sense to me. So I wrote a song about my theories as to why it got built. And the line that I thought of was, Oh, great swing bridge, where do you go? Tell me, what's your destination? Did they build you to promote pedestrianisation?
Hey! That's very good.
It always makes me laugh for some reason.
How many songs are on the album?
There are 10 songs on the album.
And is it a journey on the album? Because you know now people release, they seem to just release single and single, and nobody has albums. Which I love, because I'm of that kind of, I want to go on the journey with the band.
Mm.
Tell us about some of the songs, and is there a theme kind of running through the whole album, or...?
Well, I think the theme is stories, is telling stories. I mean, The Queen of Ella Street is about a good friend of mine who sadly passed away with cancer. But she was such an ebullient and lively person. I wanted to remember her, all the great things that were about her. And, you know, that's what I did in the song. And her son, when he heard the song, he was just, he said, "That's brilliant, Ted. That's just Maggie. That is Maggie." You know, so... and then there's Bridge to Nowhere, which I've described. There's London Calling, which is, you know, a story about a breakup, I guess. And then there's what I call my sauna songs. My sauna songs are stories that I've heard old blokes telling saunas.
Oh, right.
Which sounds dodgy.
It's a hobby. But
when I was working, I worked for 24 years as a maths teacher.
I was going to say that, I know.
And when I got to 30, I thought, this music business, you know, it's a bit dodgy. You're not going to be able to settle down and have a family, which is what I wanted to do. So I retrained as a teacher. And I ended up teaching at Hull College of Further Education. And I worked some evening classes, and I got Friday afternoons off. So I like to swim, so I used to go to the local swimming baths, and there was a sauna. So I'd have a swim, I'd go in the sauna, I'd sit there with these old guys who'd been going in there for years, you know, and they'd just talk, old talk, you know, it was just like, oh, do you remember, well, there was one about, recently, I've written a song about this guy called Les Tasker, who had an ice cream van, and he used to park it in front of this guy's house, and he used to get an extension cable from his bedroom out the window to the lamppost and run it down to the ice cream van to keep the ice cream cold at night. You know, I thought that was brilliant. And he used to work at this place called McConaughey's Kipper and Crab Shop. I mean, McConaughey's Kipper and Crab Shop. That's a song in itself. I mean, all you have to do is turn your head sideways and you can... There's a dozen songs to be written about loads of different things. Yeah, I think the theme to the album is really stories. And the sauna songs that are on the album are Len's Lion, which is a story about a guy who used to have a marble lion on the roof above his door. Because the guy was saying, what do you call the thing, that roof above your door? I says, your porch. He says, yeah, your porch. He had a lion on his porch. So the story's about, about, he used to go around to his house, you know, once a week just for a cup of tea and a natter. But he'd always say, yeah, I wish I'd put those bedding plants in earlier. And he'd say, it's all right, Len, I'll do it for you. So he'd do his bedding plants. And there'd always be something Leonard'd say, oh, I wish I'd replaced that pane of glass in the greenhouse. So he'd do that for him. Anyway, one day it was the lion above his door, you know. So he said, I really must move that lion. So they went and got the ladder out of the shed and put the ladder up. And of course, it was a marble lion, so it weighed a ton, you know. So anyway, Lynch became one of my stories, one of my songs.
One of my favourite lines of Ted in that song is, to get it up there, you must have had a lot of luck. He said, I knew a Rasta with a forklift truck. I just think that's a great line.
That is a good line.
You see, for years I just wrote songs and wrote songs. It was a form of therapy for me. I'd come home from a hard day at work and I'd either sit down at the piano and bang something, you know, just learn to play the piano, you know, self-taught on the piano. Or I'd have, you know, I'd go up and I'd have a melody and I'd think of something to write about. But when I was at work, I started writing songs for people. So there was a girl, Caroline, in our office, and she had to move offices. And she really didn't want to move office. So I wrote her this little song. I can't remember any of the lyrics, but one of the lines was about, at least you're closer to the toilets now. And that made her laugh, so, you know. And then people, you know, had moved departments or, you know, would leave work, and I'd write songs for them just as an exercise, just for a laugh, you know, because I knew I could do it. I think when I started with songwriting, I never used to write the lyrics. When I started writing lyrics, I got really embarrassed about my lyrics, and Eddie would take the Michael out of my lyrics if I presented him with a song, so I never did it. And then I got to an age where I thought, to hell with it, I'll just write what I want. I won't censor anything that I do, I'll just put it down. So now I write songs really quickly. But it's a sort of process where I have an idea, I write the song quickly, and then I'll type it up on a laptop and print the lyrics off. And then I'll continually go back to it and think, no, that needs a different line there, or that melody just doesn't work, or that doesn't fit there. And that's the polishing process that I enjoy afterwards. So, quickest to write, I don't know. I mean, there's a song called Oh Cruella, which is on the album, which is... I can't really tell you about the people that are involved because they'll probably identify themselves. But it was a situation where somebody had been really horrible to somebody that I really cared about. But I couldn't go and have it out with them. I couldn't go and pin them against the wall and tell them what horrible person they were. Mm-hmm. So, and I was really frustrated by that. I just wanted to do something, and I thought, write a song. So Oh Cruella came out, and it just came off it flew out of my fingers. You take the penny from a dead man's lid, you never pay the duty on the thing you did. It was just bang, 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 there it was all of a sudden.
So if you're out there and you think it's about you, it probably is. Just in case you're listening.
I'm trying to promote the album. It's very difficult these days. I think it was always difficult, but it seems more difficult now. But there are a lot of outlets like yourself and, so trying to build up to organising a tour maybe for April or May, which will be more comprehensive. But it's like we're talking about, it's chicken and egg, you know. Unless people have aged you, they won't pay the pound to come through the door to see you. So it's a process, really.
It is important. I go on about it all the time. It's new artists or artists that have been signed before, when you look at albums now, you can download online, or if you like a single, normally 79 pence or 99 pence. I mean, people moan, and people go out and buy a coffee. That's, and they want their music for free.
That's
and
right,
it's just getting people to realise that there is so much money you have to invest as a musician. Otherwise, it would just be for the rich.
Maybe that's partially why it's got a little bit stayed for me. There's very formulaic a lot of the songs, and something that drives me mad is you can get pitch shifting, so you can get a bad singer to sing in tune with this machine, what's it called?
Auto-tune.
But they're actually using it now, so you can actually hear it on a lot of records. Repeatedly, but banging tune. Well, that wasn't probably. Yeah, and then, because everything is done on a computer, it's much cheaper to... Yeah. I mean, you can get these programs now, which is a real drummer playing real drums, a million different styles and a million different tempos, so you can just choose your drum parts and drop it into the song. So for me, a lot of it's becoming staid and formulaic, and, the tide of technology.
Keep vinyl!
isn't it interesting how we're going back to vinyl?
Yeah.
HMV, although it's having its problems, has got loads of vinyl. I mean, I bought my wife music from the Big Pink by the band for her birthday in January on vinyl. New vinyl, really pristine. But I think people who have never had that experience are thinking, wow, that's something that you had to sit down and listen to and turn over halfway through, Which, for people who love music, love that side of it. And the artwork is big and proper, you can see it, And as we all did when we were young, pour through the back, see who produced it, who played what on where, who wrote the songs,
And you can prepare your vegetables on them.
Well, apparently, can you can do other things on them.
I know I've got in the loft, I think, Bang & Olufsen, old stereo, which I think was from somebody's parents, which I managed to get hold of.
Yeah.
And I think, I've got loads of... It's just that crackle. I was saying earlier, you just get that little crackle. Well, on my ones you do, because I scratched to death most of them. But he's got a warmth. I like vinyl.
The crackle doesn't matter.
No. But you can cut vegetables
People
on them as well.
People put crackles on records now. Deliberately.
Yeah, I know, it's not the same though, is it?
It's old school feel.
Now, if people want to get hold of the album, where do they get hold of the album?
You can go to Amazon and you can get a physical copy of it from there. You can download it. It's also on various streaming services. There are links on our website, ted-key.kingstons.co.uk, but the easiest way is to put Ted Key and the Kingstons into a search engine, and just you'll find loads of stuff on us from that.